Hello and welcome to Game Week 4 review show of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks for downloading and listening to this episode. With 9 games played this weekend, Manchester City remained the only team with a perfect record after winning at Old Trafford this week. Meanwhile, Chelsea are still unbeaten after yet another late goal by everyone's favorite real-life troll, Diego Costa. In order to review those games, I'm joined by Karthik Krishnayar. Karthik, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be with you, Nipun.
Karthik, where else would you and I start as Man United and Man City supporters about other than the Manchester Derby? Before we get into dissecting the game, I wanted to hear your overall thoughts about this game, because to me, Karthik, this felt like, it really did feel like an El Clasico. It felt, maybe it's just simply because Mourinho and Guardiola were there, but so much tactical nuance, so much, so many different pieces, so many world-class players on the pitch at the same time, two world-class managers, a sort of a derby, although El Clasico, I guess, is not a derby. So what were your overall thoughts about this game?
Yeah, I completely agree. And in fact, last night at the game between our other two teams, Fort Lauderdale and Indy 11, here in Fort Lauderdale, that was kind of the talk.
It always happens, right, Karthik?
Yeah, they always play the same weekend for some reason.
I don't know why that's such a crazy coincidence that somehow both our teams tend to play at the same time.
But the discussion at the game was, and in the press box was, what a good game this was. Mm-hmm. And you always hear after big Premier League matches, oh, it was a letdown, it was a disappointment, some sort of controversy, although there was certainly controversy in this match, but there was just talk about what a good game, how well both teams adjusted tactically, and how the game evolved. And I thought it was just a very, very entertaining game, and it had that feel of an El Clasico, even in the crowd. Obviously, Manchester derbies are big deals, but it seemed a little bigger this time, didn't it? It just seemed there was an air of anticipation, and I thought maybe it was too much hype, but as it turns out, the hype it was beyond the hype. The game, it was such an entertaining match.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the fact that two of arguably the 5 best managers in the world, I still think Guardiola is the best manager in the world, and Mourinho's top 5. So that fact, along with the fact that you had so many quality players and players who were missing as well, who were exceptional quality, like Aguero. And that's where I guess we should start this conversation, Karthik, because the biggest talking point in some ways before this game was missing Aguero. And all of us on different podcasts that you were on, that I was on, hypothesized how he would play it. And he kind of, he being Guardiola. And at the end of the day, he took a pretty sensible approach. But the way it played out was the forward, the forward line for City was not as important as was what he did in the midfield 3, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly. And I think that was almost a default thing that happened, because Pep always wants to win the tactical battle,
right?
But he was aided by the decision to start Mkhitaryan, but from Mourinho week. It was a poor decision. Mourinho's admitted it was a poor decision. He corrected it at halftime. Ander Herrera was far better, far more effective, much more dynamic, and allowed Fellaini and Pogba to get into more natural positions and really begin to control. I wouldn't say United dominated the midfield battle after halftime, but they controlled the midfield battle. The first half, De Bruyne was just running riot,
He was unbelievable.
He was just having a blinder, beyond a blinder. We'd say guys have blinders. He was having one of the best games in a big game in England that we've seen in a long time. Mm-hmm. That continued even in the second half, but United was not in any way able to cope with the movement from De Bruyne, and it put a lot of pressure on the back four. And there was the issue of Mkhitaryan not being up to pace, up to speed. And I have to say, this is a serious issue, because this was the case often at Dortmund in big games.
Right.
And he has that reputation. And part of him having that reputation is why Jurgen Klopp did not go in for him, as many people anticipated, with Liverpool, and went in and got Wijnaldum instead from may have overpaid for him, but from Newcastle, and Sadio Mane, and we're going to get to Liverpool later, but they made the decision, Klopp made the decision not to go in for Mkhitaryan. I think what we've seen in the first few matches with Manchester United and based on Mkhitaryan in big games at Borussia Dortmund is that the combination, and it depends where you want to go with this and who your opposition is, the combination of Juan Mata or Ander Herrera, not playing them both at the same time, but mm-hmm. one or the other, probably gives you as much as Mkhitaryan does. So that that was a bad decision by Mourinho, and I think that ultimately decided the game.
From a tactical standpoint, I can see what Mourinho was trying to do. He wanted to. He knew that City was going to dominate possession, as they did, especially in the first half. And he wanted to have the pace on the wings through Mkhitaryan and through Lingard. And at the same time, through Lingard, also have work rate to track the runs of someone like Sanya. But what ended up happening was every time the ball was played out to the wings to either Lingard or Mkhitaryan, there was no ball retention. Their first touch was horrible. Yeah. They let balls go through to the sideline that they really had no business letting go of. And it ended up being a situation where Mourinho was kind of had some egg on his face, because I think it was almost a sense of Mourinho trying to pull one of those, hey, look at me, I'm Mourinho, I make some incredible decisions. And what does he do? He plays Mkhitaryan, who's barely had a lick of football. He's probably played about 25 minutes combined in the first three games. He starts him in the biggest game of the season so far. Lingard, who's come back from injury a little bit, had a good start to the season. But yet again, let's...
Yeah, I don't fault him for the Lingard decision. Lingard was...
Well, here's why I fault him, Karthik, for the Lingard decision. Because midweek, Marcus Rashford scored a hat-trick for the U21s, and he has been in terrific form for Manchester's U21s as well, has been in terrific form all since the start of the season, scored the winner in the last game against Hull City in that last minute. So if you had the choice to play Lingard or Marcus Rashford, arguably Lingard gives you a little bit more defensive prowess, but if you're playing those two forward players for the sole purpose of having good counterattack, you don't leave out Rashford.
Well, that's a good point. That's a very, very good point. And then maybe he had to hold that substitution mm-hmm. because he had to make both at halftime. I would have brought Martial on earlier, but I understand because he had to burn two substitutions at halftime why Martial, who I was expecting to come on at about the 60th minute
right.
and run at City's defense at by that time, a pretty tired defense, wasn't brought on until I think minute 80. The other big tactical change, this is ultimately what won the game for Manchester City, was, and this is a direct contrast with Manuel Pellegrini, who I have a lot of time for and mm-hmm. admire as a manager, but Pep Guardiola recognized after Rashford and Herrera came on that City was losing the midfield battle, was being overwhelmed in midfield in kind of a similar fashion as United was in the first half.
Right.
He quickly brings
Fernando
on that. Yeah. That Pellegrini would make it the 75th minute, and Guardiola made it at the 57th or 58th minute. Big, big difference. And I think if Pellegrini's managing City in that match, you get a second goal from United with Rashford's work rate, and I thought Rooney had a pretty good second half. They probably get a second goal, and then it's a completely different game. So,
yeah,
quick change. And that's also something – Pep Guardiola has this reputation of not liking defensive midfielders, but when his back was against the wall, he threw one on and got out with 3 points. That says a lot about his pragmatism.
Yeah, I agree. And I think some of the things you just mentioned, Karthik, are why this game was so cool to watch. It really was like a game of chess in some – that's such a cliche, but a game of chess with some really big players. It was like a game of chess with a bunch of just one king and, you know, the rest of the players were all queens. So everyone on that pitch was larger than life in some ways and was powerful. But what ended up happening was these small tweaks that each manager made in the beginning. It was Guardiola, and he did what he had to do, which is he knew Pogba and Fellaini would be strong in midfield in terms from a physical presence. So he used the pivot of Fernandinho and then De Bruyne and Silva on either side of him. So at any given moment, one of those players, usually De Bruyne, was free because Pogba and Fellaini were trying to track the other two. It's simple when we say it that way, but it's so hard to make happen on a pitch. And that's the credit that's the big credit to Guardiola. That's why he's the greatest manager in the world. After that, as you mentioned, United comes back. Mourinho makes that tweak, brings on Herrera, changes the structure of the team. Herrera is playing as a holding midfielder. Pogba, Fellaini push up. United gains some control of the game, creates some chances. And then Fernando comes on to balance the game out. So some brilliant tactical moments. And let's talk about some of the players now. Pogba completely missing in this. Well, I shouldn't say completely missing. I think he struggled in this game to keep up with some brilliant tactical maneuvering by Guardiola. I'm sure that's been talked about. Let's talk more about Kevin De Bruyne, because De Bruyne, I think you hinted at this at the beginning, often criticized for poor performances in big games. Last season, if I remember, his best performance was that win. I want to say it was he scored two goals against Hull, maybe. I think that's what it was. And in general, you know, in and out of games. Oh, the PSG game. I guess in the PSG game, yeah. Also he scored in the semifinal.
Quarterfinals.
Quarterfinal, thank you. But other than that, Kevin De Bruyne in this game was unplayable, had the goal and hit the post twice, one of them leading to the Iheanacho goal. So do you think this is some redemption, Karthik, for Kevin De Bruyne to have this sort of performance against a manager who really honestly didn't believe in him?
Yes, I think that certainly motivated him. And he's playing at a different level, a lot of freedom of movement, and he is playing in a role where he finds a lot of space because David Silva is playing in a more withdrawn role. And that's the little tactical wrinkle that's changed. Whereas last season, you would see De Bruyne sometimes pushed wide, trying to play as kind of a double number 10 or whatever you want to call them, number 8s with David Silva, and it didn't really work in a lot of games. They'd both get marked out of games in the Premier League. We saw this also with Nasri and Silva often. If you played the two of them together, there would be all kinds of problems, and then you didn't get any natural width, and City would eventually have to bring Jesus Navas on to save games, right? So that's right. That's the position that City were often in until this kind of three-man midfield idea with which is why we have not seen Yaya Toure play in the Premier League yet. Mm-hmm. With David Silva and Fernandinho almost as a double pivot, but taking turns in various roles, and De Bruyne further up the pitch. And that's except when he comes to link up and Fernandinho bombs forward. It seems to be all very orchestrated and very organized. It's a fascinating tactical wrinkle, and it's something that's really benefiting De Bruyne, and we'll see if he can kick on from here. I tend to think he will. I also think it's important to note the intelligence of the runs that Raheem Sterling and Nolito are making to clear space for De Bruyne.
Exactly.
In the center. And this is why, again, I don't want to get too far on this. People who follow me on Twitter or read my articles know how I feel about this subject. But the British press, they don't, a lot of them don't watch the game in a very sophisticated tactical way. And they could not understand why Roy Hodgson kept picking Raheem Sterling for England during the Euros, during qualifying. They don't understand why Guardiola would throw him with all the talent Manchester City has, or supposedly has, why Sterling is an automatic starter for Guardiola. There are things he does off the ball. There are runs he makes. There are intelligent things he does in a football match that other guys don't give you.
Right.
And Manuel Pellegrini, Brendan Rodgers found that. Manuel Pellegrini found that. Roy Hodgson found that. Pep Guardiola, the best manager in the world, now found that. So just because he's a bad finisher in front of goal, which he is, doesn't mean that he should be bagged as he is by the Fleet Street Press. And he very deservingly has won Premier League Player of the Month. Mm-hmm. Sterling's movement and that of Nolito, who's been an outstanding signing, was a signing I didn't have much faith in because
– Oh, yeah, I remember.
My view was that he had never done well at big clubs and that it's always when he's at second-tier clubs that he does well, but he's certainly fitting into the system well.
Second-tier club now, so. Just kidding.
Those two guys have created enough space for Fernandinho and De Bruyne really to pick apart the defenses they're facing. And it'll be interesting also to see what happens this week in Gladbach, because that's, again, going to be another challenge against a team with a pretty good midfield that City's going to face. And we'll see if this continues.
Yeah, great point on Sterling there. I agree with that 100%. Some of that vitriol coming from Liverpool supporters as well, by the way.
Correct, correct.
Yeah.
And some of those Liverpool supporters happen to be in the media.
Yeah, yes, we don't need to explicate any more on that. I think everyone knows who we're talking about. Let's talk about Otamendi. Again, another player last season, you know, not as impressive. When he signed, I thought Manchester United had made a big mistake by not moving for him, by not securing him and letting him go to City. Initially, really struggled. In this game, I think John Stones got a lot of credit. I think Otamendi was the best defender on the day.
Yeah, I thought Otamendi was outstanding. The reason why Manchester City got him, I believe, last year was because Valencia were bad financial straits,
right,
and owed City money on the Negredo transfer. So Negredo now, of course, has gone to the Middlesbrough. But I think that's actually why City got Otamendi instead of United. They had Valencia had to pay off that debt. So that was how they got him, and he was fantastic. I agree. I think his positioning was very good. He picked the right spots to go forward. He was comfortable with the ball at his feet. What we used to expect from David Luiz, we saw from Otamendi in this game. Saw it largely from Stones also, but we've also come to expect it from Stones. And I thought those two were outstanding. Where Manchester City continues to have problems, and this is why when Martial came on and then prior to that, Rashford had a huge impact, is the fullback positions. I think that there's still some question marks about the durability for 90 minutes at this pace of Sanya and especially of Alexander Kolarov.
Yeah, those are good points. Another area was, of course, Claudio Bravo, who really struggled with crosses and which actually contributed to only goal Manchester United scored. Here's an interesting thing. I think a lot of us have analyzed the game that it was a game of two halves. Yes, Manchester United was much better in the second half, but truthfully, the only time United created any chances, clear chances, it was because of mistakes made by Claudio Bravo.
Right.
I think that's important to note, that had someone else, well, let's not say Joe Hart because of what happened at Torino, had someone else been in goal on Saturday morning, perhaps our analysis of United would have been that they were poor in both halves.
Yeah, if Caballero had started, which I was actually quite surprised he didn't. And that's something Pep Guardiola, now he has a decision to make, right? Bravo is one of the best shot stoppers in the world, best keepers in the world.
And with his feet, he's incredible.
And he's incredible with his feet. Do you let him play through this and bend him in? Or do you go back to Willy Caballero, who's not very good with his feet, quite frankly? I've seen him make mistakes the 3 years he's been at City and at Malaga before, but seems to be a more reliable look.
Yeah.
I mean, Caballero would have gotten that ball, okay, and the other one, I think he probably would have come up with two, and then the penalty shout for Rooney, which to me was a penalty. I don't know that maybe he gets caught there, but I think two of those three mistakes are probably not made by Caballero. I think they're, even though in spite of what happened at Torino today, I don't think two of those three mistakes are made by Joe Hart either. So that's the big thing now for Guardiola. Do you let him play through it? He probably does.
Right.
But,
I think so too.
It's worrying because this is what happens often when you bring a player into a new league and you throw him in on the deep end.
Especially a goalkeeper.
Right. Especially a goalkeeper. And we've seen it happen. And
especially a goalkeeper from Spain.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, David De Gea, obviously, is kind of the poster child for that. But
right.
Then if you look at Courtois, on the other hand, he played very well when he first came
right
back to the Premier League.
Mm-hmm. It's the other way with him.
Well, now you have to, and I know we're going to get to Chelsea later in the show, but now you really have to wonder, is Courtois a better option than Begovic? I'm not really sure about that anymore. But I think Bravo opened the door for Manchester United in this game in a way that when you have Rooney and an Ibra, you're able to take advantage of. And Guardiola said post-game he wanted to give Ibra credit for that goal and try and punt on the fact that it had been a horrible goalkeeper error, because it was a sublime finish, and it was kind of finish only Ibra among strikers in this world we would expect to connect with that and just finish it so cleanly. But the opportunity wouldn't be there without the goalkeeper error.
I agree with that completely. Let's move on, Karthik, from this game. We'll talk. We'll get to the Arsenal-Southampton game here in a second. But before we do that, I want our listeners to know that if you watch as much Premier League football as we do on this podcast, you need to know about Sling Blue. With Sling Blue, you can cut the cord and watch NBCSN, Fox Sports 1, Fox Sports 2, Univision, and Unimass with a free 7-day trial. You can watch the games on your computer, smartphone, tablet, Roku, Apple TV, and Xbox One. That means for this upcoming week, you can use the 7-day free trial to watch Celtic versus Barcelona and PSG versus Arsenal in the Champions League, Feyenoord versus Manchester United, and Spurs versus Monaco in the Europa League on Thursday, and Chelsea versus Liverpool in the league on Friday, and many, many more games. You do not need a cable or satellite TV subscription. Plus, with Sling Blue, you get AMC, BBC America, FX, TNT, and a ton of other channels. Sign up for the 7-day free trial to Sling Blue at worldsoccertalk.com/sling. Again, that's worldsoccertalk.com/sling. Karthik, Arsenal versus Southampton. Arsenal winning 2-1. Lucas Perez makes his debut. Arsenal's actually had a really poor record against Southampton recently, since the last two or three seasons. And I guess the game was going in some ways against plan when Tardis scored from that free kick. Amazing overhead kick from Koscielny. In the last minutes, though, Karthik, here's where the game got interesting. Last 25, 30 minutes, Arsenal piled on the pressure, but somehow didn't create too many chances until that Giroud PK.
Right, it had been a foul on the other end of the pitch. Shane Long clearly taken down in the corner, and no foul was called. I can't remember which Arsenal defender was involved, but so that led directly to the sequence that gave Arsenal their winner on the penalty kick. Look, Arsenal, I thought, was again very poor. Lucas Perez, he will get better, but he's... For Arsenal fans who for some reason don't like Giroud, even though I think he's not a world-class striker, right? He's not Ibra. He's not Lewandowski, but he's in that next tier. He's a guy who ends up creating more chances than just about any striker in the world who's not playing for Barcelona or Bayern or Real Madrid.
Are you talking Shane Long or Giroud?
No, I'm talking about Giroud. but I don't know why Arsenal fans dislike him so much. I think they just associate him with this lamentable era where they're not challenging for titles. But Lucas Perez, to me, didn't show me much. Obviously, it's his first game in the league. He's a top coming in with a strong pedigree. I thought the game changed because Giroud came on. I thought Arsenal was much better once he came on and were creating half chances, not great chances. I don't think Arsenal's midfield was particularly good in this game. I understand Wenger's rotating with PSG coming on Tuesday, a big game in the Champions League, but boy, I look at on paper this Arsenal team and think they should be giving us the types of performances that Manchester United and Manchester City do. Now, I think United has the most talent of any team in the league. I've said that July, but I don't think Arsenal is that far behind on paper, but they're just not performing, and this is the same thing we see every season, and until there's reason to change my opinion or our colleague Chris Hanage's opinion about Wenger and about Arsenal, I'm going to continue to say the same thing, which is they're going to finish fourth, maybe. They might actually finish fifth this year, because I think that there's pretty clearly four or five teams better than them right now in the league. And I don't know that they're going to have the luxury they've had these previous seasons where they've gotten to third or fourth with these poor starts of teams falling away. That might not happen this season. And I just don't like what I see from them. It's just pretty simple.
We're going to get to our top fours in section two of the podcast, Karthik, but I guess I'll give mine away here in a sec, in this way that I agree with you. For me, after watching this game, I finally put Arsenal out of my top four into fifth place. And the reason for that is, so I'm a big fan of Santi Cazorla. He scored the winner, the PK, this game. But again, for me, that pivot in midfield, the two of those midfielders, regardless if you have Xhaka there with Santi or whoever you're playing, Coquelin, I just don't see those two in midfield as a strong enough system for many of the big games, many of the games that Arsenal struggled in. And yes, Santi Cazorla is a brilliant footballer, but if he's playing, he has to be playing in those three behind the strikers and not in a holding midfield role. It's not a traditional holding midfield role, but he cannot be, if you're having an attacking lineup behind your striker like you do with Arsenal, with Joel Campbell, he's away on loan, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Theo Walcott, Ozil, etc., you need more of a strong structure in the two behind those three. And with Santi Cazorla there, and I just cannot see that working all season. It started off brilliantly last season at the beginning of the league campaign. I remember they dominated when they played United. They beat them comfortably without a traditional holding midfielder. And on the World Soccer Talk podcast, you guys were talking about it, Lawrence, you and Richard at the time, about how perhaps this is an okay system that might work. But again, as you said, it fell away in some of the other bigger games. It's just not sustainable, and that's why I think they'll be out of top four.
Yeah, and Ozil had one of the worst games I've seen him have in a game. And I just don't know. At this point, United is pretty much as good as advertised. City is as good as advertised. Chelsea is, even though they dropped points this weekend, as good as better than advertised. Liverpool, for me, maybe I had underrated them, much better than advertised. I know we're only four matches into the season. Spurs, as good as I thought they'd be. Right now, I'm already thinking Arsenal is the sixth best team in the league now that I've named those five teams. So I don't. No, maybe they get to fourth again, but they're not going to compete for the title unless some sort of mentality shift occurs. And I don't know if it's going to occur with this manager and this set of players. And I have to reference something. John Cross from The Mirror is an Arsenal fan and one of the best soccer writers in England. He senses this is Wenger's last year and senses it might be as much Wenger walking away as Arsenal sport forcing him out. He'll get to 20 years, that incredible milestone in October, and maybe he's just going to play out the string. And it would be very sad if he leaves having finished fifth or sixth, considering that record of 19 successive years in the top four is something that will never be matched in English football again. And it would be nice if he is going to go out this year to get year 20 in the top four and then just walk away. But I have my doubts as to whether that happens.
I agree with you. I mean, except, of course, when Martinez takes over at City and wins the league 19 years in a row, right, Karthik? So, okay, let's move ahead, Karthik, to two teams that Arsenal does not have great feelings about, one being Stoke, one being Tottenham. 4-0 win away from home for Tottenham. Dele Alli scores, Kane scores. But the talking point for me in this game is Son Heung-min. Son came out about a week and a half ago, said he wanted to focus on his Tottenham career. When he signed last year, Karthik, from Leverkusen, was the most expensive Asian player ever. I think it was Hidetoshi Nakata who had the record before that. Did not have the most exciting start to his Tottenham career. This game, two goals and assist, and was brilliant in those advanced attacking positions. He has a lot of competition for that spot, Karthik, likes of Lamella, Dele Alli, Eriksen, etc. But how good can this guy be?
Well, he actually probably would have had a third goal if Ali had not from Eriksen, it would have run through to Son, and he was at the back post position to score. So he might have had three goals.
Typical Englishman,
right? But no, I think Son is a very good player. I've talked to a number of folks about him when I was in Leverkusen last year. He, of course, played for Leverkusen. Fans were devastated that he was sold. Very popular player there. It took him a little bit to acclimate to English football. And I think also the problem is with guys like him, you go to a very good team in Spurs, a team that was spent most of the season trying to chase down the title, fell away the last month of the season or the last 3 weeks of the season, but was a team that was pushing for the title with a pretty much a set 11 or set 13, if you will, because Pochettino will rotate the fullbacks because of the pressing system and what he requires the fullbacks, who are normally Rosenwalker or Trippier and Davies, to do. But other than that, there isn't a whole lot of squad rotation for league games. Now that Nasser Chadli has been sold,
right,
this is the opportunity for Son to push on and push into the team. The thing that strikes me about Pochettino, which worries me about Spurs, is how thin the squad is, how many guys he's offloaded because for one reason or another. I mean, I still look at this team and look at their first 11 or first 13 and think that they can win the league. I really do. I mean, Arsenal fans, especially after we've just gotten down to eviscerating Arsenal, they're not going to like me me saying that.
Yet again, guys, KKFLA 737.
Yeah, right. We finished ahead of them 19 straight years, all of that stuff. Okay, I know that. I know that. I get that. Arsenal has been better than – or has finished ahead of Tottenham in the table 19 straight years. Whether it took food poisoning or this great Tottenham collapse last season, they have that run. But Spurs are still so good defensively. Their shape is still so good defensively, and they create turnovers by the way they press up the pitch in and it's done in a more kind of less of a frenzied way than Liverpool does. Maybe we can at some point in the future compare Pochettino's press to Klopp's press. I just really like this team, and another slow start like last season, but yesterday was again what I expected to see from them. Clicking on all cylinders, defensively very strong, controlling the midfield, really good movement from Son and from Lamella when he came on, and from Eriksen, who is one of the most underrated players in this league, maybe one of the most underrated players in Europe. I like this Spurs team, and I think that they're definitely in they're outsiders, but to me, they're definitely that outside team that's in the title hunt, and they're the team if anyone's going to chase down the two Manchester sides. I know Chelsea's ahead now in the table, but realistically, I think if someone's going to spoil that party, it probably is Spurs.
Yeah, Eriksen was terrific in this game. He was the man of the match for me. Was all over the pitch. I think he was just dominant in the final third in particular, created chances, linked up play, played some delicious through passes. I think the only player that compared for me this week, even though they didn't end up winning, was Snodgrass. I think both Eriksen and Snodgrass were exceptional this weekend. You know, playing
Snodgrass also had a hat trick international duty, by the
right,
way.
Exactly, yeah. So another thing, Karthik, that I want to talk about very quickly before we switch, before we end part one, is Harry Kane. Harry Kane scored his first goal of the season. It's been about 6 or 7 Premier League games, as you know, a trend that started at the end of last season where he hasn't scored a goal that literally anyone, even Andy Carroll, would have scored. So the goal itself is not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is the fact that when I was watching this game, I remarked on the fact that Harry Kane barely entered the opposition box. Almost all his touches were outside the box, were on the wings. And I know there's a lot of talent in this team, and Harry Kane is able to play behind the striker, but is Pochettino making a mistake here by playing Harry Kane in that way, where most of his touches, I think he had, I can think of 2 times that he touched the ball inside the box. I'm sure our listeners know an exact number. One of them was the goal, and another one that he got, that he played through for, I think, one of the fullbacks to run onto. So what are your thoughts on Harry Kane right now?
Yeah, I think that this is the thought process behind the signing of Janssen, who needs to get going at some point, and I have high hopes for players come in from the Dutch league, guys come in from the Netherlands in England. Some are hits and some aren't. I thought Janssen would be, but he's not going to Newcastle, no offense, or Norwich or one of those clubs. He's going to Spurs, who are potentially a title contender, who are in Champions League, top 4 team. So he has to hit the ground running. I think ideally with Janssen in the team, if he becomes your out and out number 9 that can score goals, you have the flexibility to drop Kane behind Janssen. You have the ability to rotate, you know, give Kane a couple spells, because he played virtually without a rest between England U21s and England in the Euros for 2 years now at a high level. And also, you can give Dele Alli a rest if you play Kane in that role, or you could be flexible where you play Eriksen. So I think the real key is whether Janssen comes up to speed and becomes the player we're expecting, or at least I'm expecting him to be, and I'm sure that the player Mauricio Pochettino is expecting him to be. Look, Pochettino hasn't made many signings these last 2 summers. He liked the core of his Spurs team. The guys he's added have been very kind of specific adds, Son, for a specific reason.
Wanyama,
and especially with Dembele suspended, and that suspension's now over, but Wanyama's actually played very well, so yeah. He may not give up his spot that easily. And then Sissoko, Janssen, who I expect to be much better with Spurs than he was with Newcastle, because I've come to the point and now we're beating up on Newcastle fans, but I've come to the point, and I can say this safely with Chris not on the pod, although he might agree with me, that you don't judge players based on how they perform at Newcastle. You didn't judge Damien Duff or Scott Parker or guys like that who were much better at all their other clubs, or Michael Owen, based on how they performed at Newcastle. And I think that might be the case with Sissoko also. He's going to a top team now. He's making a jump from a team that was fighting relegation every year to a team that's pushing for a title. So maybe that's too big a jump, but I have a sense he'll be pretty good for them.
I think Alan Shearer and the likes of Laurent Robert would disagree with you, but I think you're making a good point there about Newcastle.
David Ginola, right? But right. At least in this era, last 10 years. Yeah.
All right, Karthik, we'll be back to talk about Bournemouth, Burnley, Middlesbrough, all those three games, and talk about our end of season top fours and our player of the week in part two of the World Soccer Talk podcast. So stay tuned. Section two of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Let's start, Karthik, with Bournemouth's win against West Brom. Callum Wilson scores the only goal. This is the, you know, he's like the phoenix rising from the ashes, isn't he? He had that horrible injury after starting off so well last season, the ACL injury, and he scores an absolutely delicious back flick here. In general, Karthik, my thoughts on the game, Bournemouth were dominant. Had it not been for some excellent saves from Ben Foster, Bournemouth could have won this game maybe by a more flattering margin. But here's what I want to talk to you about, the only thing I want to talk to you about in this game. Bournemouth themselves are very vulnerable from set pieces. Every time I watch them defending a set piece, whether it's, you know, whether it's they're not being organized by Borch, or if it's the fact that Simon Francis or Stephen Cook just don't seem to organize that defense very well, they seem very vulnerable by that from that situation. Something that Eddie Howe, as one of the most talented young English managers, really has to sort.
Yeah, and I think also we're looking at a situation probably where this is the only way West Brom is going to stay in the league is by scoring on set pieces. So this was as one-sided a game as we saw this weekend, in spite of some of the other score lines. West Brom has nothing to offer. Some really good slick play from Bournemouth, especially after Jack Wilshere came on, it must be said.
That's true.
So that's
Jordan Ibe as well had a good game.
Oh, Jordan Ibe was fantastic in this game, and you could see why they spent the money on him. He didn't really pan out for Liverpool, but he had so many guys to compete with. I think here he's going to be him, and I'm pretty excited about him and Wilshere potentially playing together, how good that could look. But you have to look at the other side of this. I agree with you on the vulnerability on set pieces, but West Brom, that seems to be their only default tactic, is to draw set pieces and try and stay in games where they're getting run over, like this match. They got run over in this match completely. That seems to be their only tactic. And Pulis, who I've defended in the past now, is showing his true
sometimes
colors. Right, I've defended him sometimes, but he has to have this big transfer budget. That's the problem. He can't he's going to complain. He's not going to organize. He can get you short-term results, but then after a while he's going to start complaining about not being able to buy players and not work within the resources of the club he has, the budget he has. So we saw this happen at Palace, and it blew up, and it's blown up now at West Brom. And there's a very good chance he's going to be out soon. And the talk is Roy Hodgson maybe will be the guy to take over, and that would be interesting because Hodgson's done well with this club before and has done well within the budgetary constraints of West Brom. But Hodgson, if he came in, would be wholly dependent on doing something in the January window. So I just think West Brom is now one of the bottom three in my mind. I just can't see them getting out unless something miraculous happens, or that there are enough really bad teams at the bottom of the division, which there might be. But right now, I don't see it. I think I just have this assumption Stoke will pick up and Sunderland will pick up. Moyes' teams always start slow. Sunderland always starts slow. So that's a lethal combination. If you consider those two things, I just don't see how West Brom is not one of the three worst teams in the league.
Two other teams who will probably be in the relegation battle, Karthik, played out what as you and I were talking before we started recording, what I considered to be the best game outside of the Manchester Derby this weekend. The 1-1 draw between Burnley and Hull City was an absolute joy to watch. Hull City we've talked about how Mike Phelan set them up to absorb possession and hit on the counter attack. This game, Karthik, Hull City absolutely dominated possession. They were brilliant in this game. Robert Snodgrass is a magnificent, looks like a rejuvenated, magnificent footballer right now. As you said, he had a hat trick midweek. One of my favorite moments of this whole weekend was the pass he played for Mailer, who hit the post in this. If you haven't watched the highlights of this game, go check out this pass Snodgrass plays from close to the halfway line. Perfectly weighted pass. Mailer first touch, hits the post. Absolutely magnificent. And that midfield card they got, Snodgrass, Huddlestone, Mailer, Diomande, is really coming along in their ability to, I guess the understanding they have of each other. One will hold, one will be more attacking. They actually interchange across midfield. So it's not like two, you know, we often talk about midfielders as two holding midfielders or one attacking midfielder, one defensive midfielder, and two wingers. These four midfielders swap positions, at least in this game they did, they swap positions throughout this game. Just awesome to watch.
Yeah, and Huddleston is our colleague Chris Henage, like players in English football that can really control the tempo of a match.
Right.
And when he's playing in an interchangeable role like this, he can dictate the tempo and dictate the play, and his team tends to dominate possession when he's able to do that, which he was able to do in this match. So I thought he was very good too. And Mailer has been very good this entire season thus far. Snodgrass speaks for himself, speaks for itself. His success for Hull this season, coming back from that terrible injury 2 seasons ago. Right. Remember, they got relegated, I think, largely because he was injured that year. Mm-hmm. And of course, his play for Scotland midweek. Burnley, this is the kind of game they need to win. They need to get 3 points in this sort of game. That having been said, I thought they were very good. They had some nice slick passing of themselves. A great goal by Stephen Defoe. Yeah. And obviously Defoe is a player that, to me, it could be the X factor, right? He could be one of the real under the radar signings of this summer.
Totally agree.
Could work his way back into now Roberto Martinez's setup with Belgium.
Here we go.
Yeah, no, we'll save that for another day. But
Karthik, we need to start a new segment in World Soccer Talk podcast. Karthik talks about Martinez this week. That's the name of the segment.
Right. Unfortunately, with them managing an international team, we only get to do it during international breaks.
I'm sure you'll find a way, Karthik.
But Stephen Defoe, I think, is a really good signing. These teams are both playing above their level right now.
Yes.
But Burnley needed the 3 points in this game. Again, this is another point for Hull that maybe they wouldn't have been expected to take. They almost took a point against Manchester United. We're unlucky in that game.
Yeah.
You should be feeling some pride as a United guy, Nipun. Mike Phelan showing he can manage at this level, and also making David Moyes look rather silly for running him off when he took over from Sir Alex Ferguson. For me right now, Hull, it's hard to think that they're going to keep this up, but. And their next 3 games are very difficult, but they're still going to enter the month of October with 7 points. They might just have enough to stay up because they've got a thin squad, obviously, but the way Snodgrass and Huddleston are playing, and Mailer, those three guys,
right.
The way those three guys are performing at this point, that's enough to keep a team in this division.
I totally agree. And speaking about Stephen Defoe, that goal from him, I mean, that was something that if someone like Pogba scored it, it would be replayed over and over again because he has this brilliant turn at the halfway line, absolutely brilliant, runs about 30 yards, well, to be fair, kind of unopposed, and then rifles one. So just an excellent goal. If you haven't watched it, make sure you check out Stephen Defoe's goal for Burnley. Karthik, Middlesbrough losing to Palace. You and I last podcast talked about how Wilf Zaha just kind of crazy that he wanted to move away from Palace and to Tottenham. He had one goal, one assist in this game, you know, really asserted himself on this game. He had a couple of normal Zaha moments, which meant crosses that went closer to his own goal than they did to the goal of the opposition. But in general, was very good, full of tricks. So I guess at this point, we have to talk about Zaha in this Palace team. Has he got his head back on straight? Is this something that will continue, or is the erraticism of Zaha still going to continue to hold him back?
Oh, the erraticism. When you started to tease this whole thing about how brilliant game, I thought, well, we know he's capable of this. The next game, he'll probably be all terrible.
Right.
And they're going to really regret having sold Bolasie because he just consistency is an issue for him. I think mentally he's not strong enough
right.
to weather some of these bad performances or adverse performances. He has seems to have a inflated impression of where he should be in terms of his career, and he had the opportunity and he didn't take it at Manchester United. So he's a great mystery. I think important for Palace in this game was that Benteke got a goal.
Right. And yeah. Good point.
And they looked good with him playing in that that striker role, with his, playing with his back to goal and also running at defenders. I was disappointed. I mean, Ayala made the mistake actually on Benteke's goal, but then he came back and got the goal for Barrow. I was though disappointed with Barrow. I really thought that games like this at the Riverside, they weren't going to let up, and they seemed to. There were points in this game where they just were not. Were not very good. Although when they had set piece opportunities, mm-hmm. Stuart Downing with that brilliant left foot is still very dangerous. All these years later, I mean, he's a guy who's made a great career right. out of a good left foot and some versatility. Remember, we saw him play even in that number 10 role at times for yeah. West Ham a few years ago.
He's played everywhere. False nine, yeah. behind the striker.
He's played on the back line. He's in yeah. a pinch.
Exactly. So he there's a James Milner about him that should right. be appreciated. Stuart Downing, that is. Karthik, one last question here. Do you think now that Palace is a good fit for Benteke? Because when you mentioned that, I'd actually forgotten that Benteke was the one who scored from the Zaha cross. That goal, that header, was a very Aston Villa-esque goal, in the sense the kind of goal that Benteke became famous for before he moved to Villa. And when you see that Tony, not Tony Pulis, sorry, Pardew's system relies on wingers. Is this move for Benteke, is this something that we haven't considered, that this move could possibly revitalize his career? Because the kind of football Palace plays is suited to him. Whereas at Liverpool, under Klopp, a style of football where you're not going to get a lot of crosses, where most of the creation is coming from the players themselves crossing physically, as yeah. opposed to the ball being crossed to you, it just wasn't tailor-made for him, was it?
No, right. At Liverpool, it was a mismatch. The second Klopp got appointed, we knew it was going to be a problem, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he hadn't started that yeah. well under Rodgers. It wasn't terrible by any right. means, but we knew that Klopp's system relies on guys pressing high, high-energy players, and guys doing a lot of dribbling. That's why Coutinho right. fits. That's why Firmino fits. That's why Lallana fits.
What about at Palace? Do you think it's a better situation for him? Do you think yeah. it'll work?
I think it could work. I think it certainly has a better chance of working than it was under Klopp,
yeah.
right? So you're going to get the wide players, and we saw this even at Newcastle, how well it worked with crosses coming in for Demba Ba and Cisse, mm-hmm. Finishing chances. And I think, especially with the kind of pace they have out on the wings at times, Palace, that there's a real opportunity for Benteke, and he took his chance in this game. So, by the way, Benteke's brother has also been signed by Palace.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
What position does he play, do you know?
I'm not sure, but he was yeah. on the bench yesterday.
Sounds like he, much like his older brother, enjoys sitting on the bench. Karthik, let's talk about our end-of-season top fours and the player of the week. This is something that we're going to start back up. End of the season for me, Karthik, top fours. I have switched it around a little bit. I still have United winning, even in spite of City comfortably, let's be honest, comfortably beating United. United first, City second. Chelsea is in third now. I had them fifth at the start of the season. I think that Conte has... my worry with that team was that they would not have a good start of the season. I thought they'll get much stronger at the end of the season. But because of the play of Diego Costa and Hazard, they've been excellent for third for me, and Tottenham in fourth. Karthik, your top fours?
Yeah, same four teams. I'm just going to reverse it a little bit. I'm going to have City 1.
Look at that, Karthik.
United 2.
Look at that. From
this is
fifth.
Something to change. Yeah. This is something to change. 3, I'm going to have Spurs, and 4, Chelsea. I am very tempted to put Liverpool in my... You talk about changing from 4th or 5th yeah. for City to 1st. I mean, I had Liverpool 9th in the preseason. I'm going to just live this down the whole season, right?
You're at City 5th, so...
Yeah, but Liverpool could finish first or second the way they're playing. Yeah, I still got them at fifth, but gosh, you know, if Liverpool's defense holds up,
That's the big one, right? That's the
yeah,
problem.
But if their defense holds up, it's pretty scary. Because yeah. I don't think anyone's going to keep up with them. We just saw it in going back to the first week, the 15 minutes against Arsenal when they got on top. Right. They suffocated them. And they were – Arsenal, if you go back and look at that game, and I hate to – we're really going after Arsenal today. Arsenal was lucky.
KKFLA 437.
Yes. KKFLA 737 on Twitter. Arsenal was lucky it was 4-1 at that point.
Yeah.
Lucky it wasn't 5-6-7-1. Yeah. And that game could have very easily been another 8-2, honestly. Yeah. So Liverpool has that capability, and I'm now beginning to think, wow, I didn't like the player moves they made. I love Klopp, but maybe Klopp has gotten this particular set of players, most of whom he inherited from Rodgers, to buy in. He had a summer with them, and look at how they're playing.
Yeah, I still have some reservations. We'll get to those when we talk about Liverpool. Karthik, let's talk players of the week. For me, it's De Bruyne. I thought he was magnificent, as I've mentioned earlier, so I don't need to explain why. So, Karthik, your player of the week.
Gosh, between Etienne Capoue and Rob talked a lot about Snodgrass, so I'll go with Capoue just because we haven't talked about him yet. I think he's become this very dominant central midfield player that we'd expect. At Spurs, ironically enough, now his former Toulouse teammate Sissoko has been signed by Spurs to play a similar role to what I think they had anticipated Capoue would play. He's playing more box to box role than a holding role at Watford and doing it brilliantly. Had a very good season last year, has been very good to start this season, and was just brilliant. Just absolutely brilliant on Saturday. The trouble for Watford was out wide. They couldn't really contain. Holobas had a hard time with Antonio and Payet's movement. But when you score four goals unanswered, it doesn't matter if you concede these early goals. I know we'll get to that game in the next segment, but I'm going with this week.
When we come back, we'll talk about Watford's win against West Ham, Swansea's draw with Chelsea, as well as Liverpool's comfortable win against Leicester City, and very quickly preview the Sunderland-Everton game. Stay tuned for Section 3 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Section 3 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. We're going to start with Watford's win, Karthik, over West Ham. West Ham looked to be running away with the game early with a couple of early goals. Antonio scoring from a deflected header. Arguably the worst goal celebration since the dab. Please, kids, if you're listening, do not imitate and make that thing happen, because I'm tired of the dab already as well. So Ighalo scored, though, Karthik. And that, when it became 2-1, that, you know, as we often say, that goal before halftime, changing it from 2-0 to 2-1, can change games. And it really did in this game. Ighalo with that goal. Then, of course, his good friend and strike partner Deeney scored another, and then Watford ended up scoring another two and ended up winning 4-2. Good stuff. Here's the question. Nothing to do with soccer. Trouble with West Ham fans. This time at the new stadium. At the end of last season, Karthik, stuff was the last game of the season at Manchester United versus West Ham. Was it the last game? It was one of the last games. Involved a lot of violence.
Yeah, it was the last game.
Yeah, the last game at the Bullion Ground, that is, involved some fan violence with stuff being thrown at the Manchester United bus. You know, we kind of laugh at the idea of Green Street hooligans and all that stuff, but genuine question, are the West Ham fans the most trouble-causing fans in the league?
In the Premier League?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, that's right.
Indisputable, right, at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to cast a wide brush. West Ham has done a lot to try and clean up its image through the years. They are a club with this reputation going way back. West Ham's a bit of a contradiction, right, because they are the great English club.
Right.
They're the club of Bobby Moore. They're the club of Jeffers. They're the club of Frank Lampard Sr. And
did you say Francis Jeffers?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Frank Lampard.
Just making
Senior.
Sure that you
and
didn't
Frank,
say
Frank
Francis
Lampard and Frank Lampard Senior and okay. Rio Ferdinand, etc. Michael Carrick, all these great English players, they also have this kind of ugly side to their fandom. I mean, I heard horror stories from journalists about their trip to Palermo in, I believe it was in the Europa League or UEFA Cup when Alan Pardew managed them, one of those seasons, 2006, 2007, something along those lines, 2005, when the Palermo fans who have a bit of a reputation within Italian football circles were petrified, were terrified because of the way these West Ham fans had come into town. West Ham has worked hard to clean up their act, but then they got drawn in a League Cup tie or an FA Cup tie with Millwall, and there were problems. That's a focal point. There should never be those two clubs should never be drawn together as close as they are geographically to one another. And then last season, what we saw to the Manchester United little bus, just a disgraceful scenes. And then this, it's very worrying. So it's
What does a club do at this point? I mean, they've tried to David Gold has tried to come suggest that things are better, and maybe they are better, but compared to the rest of the league, it's in some ways it's embarrassing to have the second largest stadium in the country and have this sort of thing manifest itself.
Right, you don't want to do what Chelsea did, which was essentially have blacklists and electrified fences and all these things to keep and raise ticket prices to the point where good, decent, hardworking, ordinary fans who support West Ham and support Chelsea aren't able to get into the ground, and they have to travel. They have to travel to away dates to get cheaper tickets. Right. You don't want to be in that position. That's what Chelsea did. Chelsea had a similar problem. Let's not forget. And they cleaned up their act through very draconian means, electrified fences, which was a really kind of a disgusting
about
a, thing.
About as draconian as it gets.
Right. Yeah, and raising ticket prices, keeping blacklists, making sure certain fans couldn't travel to Europe when they went to Europe. But Chelsea doesn't have this problem anymore. Although they did have, I guess, some incidents right on
the train, racist incident.
But by and large, they haven't had these problems since they really cracked down. I don't want another club to do what Chelsea did, honestly. I think that they went well over the top, but. Chelsea doesn't seem to have the problem anymore. So Gold and Sullivan both want to clean it up. Karen Brady wants to clean it up. I know she's pretty embarrassed. But that's two of the last three home matches they've played that this has happened. Something ugly has happened. So that's a big problem. And the thought was to move to the Olympic Stadium would bring a different type of fan in. Or maybe changed kind of the ambiance, because the Bowling Ground was always – I have to tell you, I went to a West Ham game in – 2009 against Arsenal at the Bowling Ground, and it was the most scared I was going into a football ground ever. Now, granted, I haven't gone to football matches in Russia or in Latin America or some of the places with reputations, but I've gone to a number of matches in England, and Germany, and in Western Europe, and obviously tons of matches in the United States, a few matches in Mexico. I was terrified. I mean, there was just something about that place. So I thought, okay. Whatever. What happened at the last match against Manchester United? Terrible. It was reprehensible that happened, and the match was played after that. But I just figured it wouldn't be a problem at the Olympic Stadium. But I thought part of it was the Bowling Ground and Upton Park and that whole atmosphere. But this is a big problem.
Yeah. You said, Karthik, that something ugly happened, and that's about the most perfect transition to talk about Diego Costa. And Chelsea. Swansea draws 2-2 with Chelsea. Costa scores early. Then he misses one of the easiest chances of the season at an absolute tap-in. Swans score. Let's talk about that goal here, Karthik. Antonio Conte, brilliant defensive manager, as we know. The thing I've always noticed is teams tend to control counter-attack really well. And I'd say his teams are the best at controlling counterattacks. We saw that Juventus with Italy, they managed to create a system where counterattacks become almost negligible. For some reason, though, in this counterattack, poor old 600-year-old John Terry is being asked to track Sigurdsson. It's kind of a comedy to watch, Karthik. Sigurdsson is about at parity with him at the halfway line. Halfway between the halfway line and the box, Sigurdsson is about 30 yards ahead of John Terry. And then, of course, Courtois is the one that takes him down. But Antonio Conte, perhaps not making the right moves in the way he's setting up this Chelsea team to prevent the counterattack.
Right, and keep in mind that there had been a significant change made by Gunnar. I should have just let Neil Taylor go for the rest of the half and then made the change at halftime. He made the change in the 41st minute. But then again, you could argue if Jose Mourinho had swapped out Mkhitaryan for Herrera a little earlier, City might not have gotten the second goal, right? So maybe you do make that change in the 41st minute. Anyway, Mo Barrow coming on, I think, changed Chelsea's defensive assignments. And Barrow led directly to that goal. And mm-hmm. and I wonder if maybe someone had to track Barrow. I'd have to watch the goal again. Had to track Barrow that normally would not have had to and would have been watching Sigurdsson. And that mismatch with Terry wouldn't have occurred. Mm-hmm. I wonder about that because I think it might have been because of that change. This is a stereotype about Italian managers seeing the game differently than other managers do. But I've noticed Conte, Gudain, and Mazzarri at Watford, oh, and obviously Claudio Ranieri, but those three, the three I just named in particular, making interesting tactical tweaks in the middle of games already right. this season that have changed the trajectory of results. So it's good to have so many Italian managers in the Premier League. That's one of the things I'm going to take away from this game. This was a great game to watch, and it was partly because of the two managers.
Yeah, and another person who was looking on, Karthik, was David Luiz, and he would have been absolutely thrilled to see what what Cahill did, because he would have been like, oh, right, a man out of my old book.
How does Cahill get caught in possession like that? I know there's a lot of controversy that maybe Leroy Fair fouled him. I'm not sure. I think
I don't think so.
I'd probably swallow the whistle there, too, and let Fair play on and score that goal. That's shocking from a guy in Cahill who is central defender for mm-hmm. England and a guy with all of this experience to just get caught in that situation.
And not and only then, caught Karthik, it was being caught in a strange situation because it wasn't as though Leroy Fair came up from behind him and
right.
I mean, Cahill saw him coming towards him the entire time. It just beggars belief why he didn't get rid of that ball.
Right. And that was a stunning a sequence of events because Chelsea's 1-0 up. I thought before Costa's initial goal that Swansea were the better team. Mm-hmm. First 20 minutes, 25 minutes, whenever that goal was scored. Then it seemed like they went into the tank. Gudain makes this change. He brings Taylor off. He brings Barrow on because he sees the way the game is going and that they're probably going to need to rely on some counterattacking and some pace. They're losing the midfield battle after that. And then Chelsea has 2, 3, 4 good chances, not half chances, good chances to get a second goal. They don't get it. And then just like that, Swansea gets the two goals. And then after that, I mean, the game was open. Both teams, yeah. It seemed like, had chances. Chelsea had the better chances. Obviously, the brilliant equalizer from Costa. But I tell you what, the Premier League kind of was sleepwalking the first few weeks, right? And it wasn't that entertaining. But I think we had three really high-quality games this weekend with the Manchester derby, the Hull game against Burnley, and then this game mm-hmm. this morning. Probably the three best games of the season, maybe other than probably the three best games of the season, honestly. I think Liverpool-Arsenal was entertaining, but I think that was entertaining because of Arsenal's mishaps more than
that. Was just a bunch of clownery was what that was. Right. It was just funny. So, by the way, big shout out to Fabianski. I thought he had some great saves to keep Chelsea at bay until that equalizer, of course. Karthik, let's talk about the final game we're going to review, which is Liverpool's win against Leicester City. Liverpool started with Lucas at centre-back, and it actually contributed to the only goal that Leicester City scored. Here's a couple of things. I mean, we'll talk about Liverpool, I guess, in a minute. But as you post to me, I'm going to post it back to you. Are we worried about Leicester City?
Yeah, I'm worried that they're not able to replicate. It seems like all of their key contributors have dropped off. Drinkwater is not as dominant in the midfield without Conte flanking him. Mahrez seems to be becoming more and more selfish than he was last year, taking 2-3 guys on, being dispossessed, not looking for an outlet ball. Vardy's finishing touch has somewhat eluded him. And then I would say Mark Albrighton isn't putting in the kind of defensive work he did last year. So those four guys, I'm concerned that they've all dropped off. I'm also concerned that with having signed two high-profile strikers in Ahmed Musa and now Slimani. Slimani's a fantastic signing, right, mm-hmm. on paper. But that means you're not going to see as much of Okazaki, and so much of their success was due to Okazaki's work rate last season. So I have a lot of concerns, and then obviously not having Conte has exposed Morgan and Huth to a lot more attacks right up the middle than they were seeing last season, and they're not coping very well with it. So there are a lot of issues. That having been said, the player they've signed, Slimani, he has the ability to be a 15 to 20 goal scorer in the Premier League. And you add that to Vardy, who is that, and Mahrez, who is that. If these two guys get going, Leicester still has, at least going forward, an awful lot of firepower. I mean, as much firepower as anyone outside the top four or five teams. So I think there are concerns about the work rate of players, Mahrez, Albrighton, and then not having Okazaki in the team. Those would be my biggest concerns.
Yeah, from my perspective, I think when we were previewing this game for the ULF podcast, Gabe and I were talking about this. For me, the big difference between Liverpool versus Leicester last season versus Liverpool versus Leicester this season, when we were previewing it at least, was I felt Leicester City was there to be had in the center of the park because there's a lot more lateral movement across Leicester's midfield than there was last season. Last season, the idea was Conte gets the ball, passes it to Drinkwater, Drinkwater plays it to Vardy. And it was as simple and as complicated as that, including Mahrez as well. This season, regardless of who's played alongside Drinkwater, whether it's been Nampalis Mendy, this week it was Amarte, there's a lot more, the build-up is much slower, there's the separation between the two players is much larger, and therefore you find Drinkwater having to drop a lot deeper than he was last season.
Yeah.
It's leading to a lot of breakdown in those lines between midfield and the forward line. So there's a lot, the overarching theme here is the loss of N'Golo Kanté, but there's a lot more going on in terms of the midfield structure than just that player. So,
yeah, do you shift tactically to a different formation now?
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think it might be time to actually play around with a 4-2-3-1 because right. Okazaki has not had the start. And in my opinion, I think Okazaki would work fantastically coming in from the wing, you know, from a left side or the right side of a wing behind someone like Vardy. I think it might be time to play. We might need old school Tinkerman
back. But they have five strikers now. I mean, they have...
That's it, right?
Musa can play on the wing, right? Okazaki could play on the wing. So then that leaves you with three... Well, Vardy technically could play on the wing too. That leaves you with Slimani and Ojoa who cannot, but...
Ojoa is the one that obviously can't. He would be the target man, but maybe Vardy could be played behind an Ojoa. Ezekiel, what was his name? Gray, the young
Damari Gray could play on the wing.
Exactly, and that's an option I think they need to look at. His wing play was very impressive in the few games he had last season, so maybe to incorporate him into that mix. So yeah, that's a Leicester City conversation, but Liverpool, Karthik. We were talking.
And by the way, Liverpool fans, we talk about Leicester first because they are the champions. Let's just remember that before you guys get upset and say, "Oh, you're talking about this team that's in 17th. They won the title. You guys haven't won a title in 20 some odd years." But go on.
No, Karthik. Yeah, let's rub it in their face a little bit. Jamie Vardy 1, Steven Gerrard 0. How about that? How's that to rub it? All right, Karthik. So Liverpool. Let's talk about Liverpool. So. For me, then this game, I noticed it more than I did even in the Arsenal game. The interchange of Sturridge and Firmino is magnificent to watch because Sturridge is always obviously going to be the one the ball is going to be directed to because of how brilliant he is. But a lot of the time, Sturridge was running out to the wing, and every time he did that, Firmino was cutting in, and it completely destroyed any sort of marking that Leicester City had. And multiple times in this game, Karthik, the Leicester City back line didn't look like a line. It looked more like you could make a box around it because the fullbacks were so far back. The center lines were pushed forward. You could literally probably make a box out of those four players.
Yeah. This was really good. And you know, the thing that I really like about Firmino, the more and more I watch him, and I saw some of this at Hoffenheim too. At Hoffenheim, he would play generally behind the strikers or behind the striker in 4-2-3-1. He just his movement is so dynamic, isn't it? I mean, he doesn't. If you're trying to pigeonhole him into being, is he a number 9? Is he a number 10? Is he a number 8? Should he play as a wing wide player? You can't logically put him in any of those positions. So you think, well, why is this guy even out there? Why isn't Coutinho playing or Rigi or, you know, whoever, Benteke last season? But it's just his movement is so dynamic and his understanding of the movement of Coutinho when Coutinho plays. Obviously, he didn't start yesterday, but Sturridge, as you mentioned, Lallana. It's just really good. And you know, let's get to this whole Newcastle conversation. Wijnaldum has been a much better player. I mean, maybe his finishing is still there, but I think his movement's been pretty good. He's been a much better player than I expected.
I don't know about that. When I see, I still think Wijnaldum was a better player last season at Newcastle. I don't think he has been very good at Liverpool. I think he's been guilty of striking the ball from areas that he has no business striking the ball.
That's true.
Last season, some of those goals went in, but this season he's been guilty of it way too often, of just missing shots. I think the 4-3-3 is ideal for Wijnaldum, but somehow, I don't know if it's being on because he's on the other side of Henderson or an effect that Lallana sometimes can over-embellish. I think Wijnaldum has a lot more to give Liverpool. And when I look at Liverpool, the areas that I worry about is not those attacking midfielders. They're absolutely brilliant. And you know, sometimes they can be guilty of not putting the ball in the net, but they'll always create chances. The parts I worry about is that midfield, is the defense. And right now, Wijnaldum, I think, should be the first one out of the team when Emre Can comes back in.
Okay, potentially, right. Although maybe you don't get as much dynamic movement and all of that if you make that change. But you have to consider that if you're Klopp. I thought, well, why are they signing Sadio Mane, who's a player I like?
Right.
But why are they signing him? They have so many attacking players. They've complained those advanced positions. Why do they need another one? But he's just on another level, though. How good has he been? Right. And this is, again, why I picked Liverpool real low, because I felt like they hadn't really addressed their needs with some of the signings they made. They signed a goalkeeper in Karius, who's probably going to be good. Oh, Mignolet was very good yesterday. I didn't really care for their defensive signings. Matip is a player I've seen get caught in some uncomfortable positions with Schalke. I wasn't in love with the Wijnaldum signing. And as far as Mane, I rate him highly, but I thought, well, you know what? They have all kinds of other players who play in that role. Why are they signing him for so much money? He could help Arsenal more than he could help Liverpool, was my thinking. But he's been just so good. He's been off the charts good. And gosh, I mean, he's a guy that seems to have such confidence with the ball at his feet and a string on the ball, and picks the right pass or the right shot. Well, maybe he's in a good moment, but again, I think we talked about this before. There are very few guys who are not number nines who play for teams outside the top four that can get you double-digit goals every season. He scored double-digit goals two straight years with Southampton, Premier League goals, not in all competitions, obviously, definitely in all competitions, but double-digit Premier League goals. Now that he's on a good team, right, can you imagine how many goals he's going to get this season?
Well, here's the conundrum with Sadio Mane, and we can end with this before we get a preview of Sunderland Everton, but at Southampton, at times he was unplayable. Actually, against Liverpool, how good was he? Southampton versus Liverpool, I think he scored a couple of goals.
This is the theory as to why you sign guys, because they play
against Liverpool.
Same thing with Manchester City signing Sterling. Liverpool fans can appreciate this. He always played well against Manchester City. Sure, so it's a logical signing.
And I think with Sadio Mane, the only issue is when he is mentally happy, when he feels like a part of the group, he's an exceptional player. There was that time when he had asked for a transfer, or whatever the truth is, in January, I remember when people were linking him to Manchester United. After that link happened and he wanted to move away, he was not a very good player. So that suggests to me that he needs to be loved, he needs to be appreciated. And as long as he has that at Liverpool, and maybe you hinted at this when you said at a bigger club, he will continue to give you these brilliant performances, the likes that we haven't seen at Liverpool since, you know, the Suarez-Sturridge link-up days. So good points there, Karthik. Karthik, let's end tonight's podcast with a very quick preview of Sunderland-Everton. Couple of talking points, as we often do these days on the World Soccer Talk podcast and on other podcasts. It's the two managers, Moyes versus Koeman, two managers that you and I have a lot of time for. But right now, Koeman's Everton is far ahead of the program of where I expected them to be.
Yeah, I think they've started well. I think Gareth Barry is playing very well. You know, Sissoko's a natural replacement or guy who can complement McCarthy. They have a confident team. Kevin Morales getting pretty much back to his best. Delafeu seems to be thriving in Koeman's system. It's early, but we've liked what we've seen from them. Now, with David Moyes and Sunderland, I have to remind folks that David Moyes' Everton teams always tended to start slow, and Sunderland always starts slow. Now, of course, unfortunately for Moyes, they never finished the season with the manager they started. So unlike Everton, who was very patient with them, and he'd eventually guide them into the top half and sometimes even into the top five or six in the league and then qualified for Europe after these slow starts. Sunderland doesn't quite have that patience. Sunderland is a mess. I mean, I think he's inherited a team that's just a mishmash of players, right? A team mm-hmm. that's got guys that have been bought, or again, because they start seasons with one player, one coach, manager, and end with another, guys that are that are just kind of piecemeal, and he's having mm-hmm. to work through that. He's gotten two of his old boys in, Steven Pienaar and Anichebe. Let's see if
and like two or three of players that he worked with at Manchester United, Donald Love, McNair, and
Giannis. Right. So he's going back. This is a familiar Moyes trait, right? He's going to players he's familiar with, and he inherited Jack Rodwell, mm-hmm. a player that he brought through the ranks.
Right. Right. Good point. I forgot about that.
So maybe he'll get a familiarity with this, and I think they were very happy that they were able to get Mika, the Portuguese goalkeeper, get some special dispensation to sign him. He's a goalkeeper that is very highly thought of in the Portuguese league, Swiss goalkeeper, I should say, but mm-hmm. Swiss Portuguese goalkeeper. But they were able to bring him in because Manone is hurt, and they were looking at if they weren't able to get the Premier League to sign off on this move after the transfer deadline, they were looking at Jordan Pickford for 3 months.
Right.
Because Joe Hart decided that he would go to Torino rather than go to Sunderland. Sunderland's a club, I think, now with a reputation, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And even an English player like Hart says, yeah, I'll take my chances abroad. So they caught a break there, but I just fear for them that this is going to be a start where they start similarly to where they started a few years ago under De Canio, and then Poyet had to bail them out. Now it's happened every year, right? Since
right,
but this is going to be a tough one. I think Everton probably at least gets a draw in this game.
When we come back next week, we will have the exact result of that Sunderland-Everton game. By the way, I'm predicting an Everton win in this one. And also, we'll have all the games for next week. We'll probably have Chris back, and we'll have the result of the analysis of what will be an excellent game between Chelsea and Liverpool on Friday. So until then, on behalf of everyone here at World Soccer Talk, myself, Nipun Chopra, Karthik.
Enjoy your football.